A few years back, there was this guy who was the first Australian to enter this solo around-the-world sailing race or something like that. And he bragged how he was the first person from Australia to ever do this before. And basically, he was letting everyone know how great he was because he was the first Australian to do this. And why not? That's how you get famous, isn't it? Being famous, wouldn't that be nice? So I thought I'd try it. I want to tell you how great I am. For example, I'd like to tell you what a great computer operator I am. Of course, the only trouble like that is when I see guys like Tim who really know what they're doing and have degrees and they work on it as a professional, I realize that I'm just this amateur who knows a few neat tricks. Perhaps I could tell you what a great preacher I am. And then I think about all the pastors I've served with over the years. I think of all the pastors of the churches I've attended since I was a child. And I realize I'm pretty average. I'd like to be able to tell you all those other areas where I'm just the greatest there is. But the truth is, I can't think of any. The fact is, I'm just an ordinary person. Just like everybody else. I am good at some things. And maybe not so good at others. Ask James. I'm not a very good bowler. How terrible it is to be average. But this doesn't depress me. Because I know that what I'm here on earth to do doesn't depend on my greatness or my ability. It depends on the power of Christ who works within me. In fact, as we're going to discover in today's passage from 2 Corinthians, to brag about your particular abilities is just foolish. You see, greatness is a fleeting thing. And it's a comparative thing, isn't it? I may be great compared with some, but there are plenty others who make me look ordinary. As soon as I begin to boast in my own strength or ability or power, I open myself up to the reality of my own limitations. And this is what Paul realized. Address some of the complaints that people in Corinth were making about him. Obviously, there were some people who had come to Corinth on Paul's heels. And these people were bad-mouthing him. We've seen how he pointed out that he was the first to come to the Corinthians with the gospel. These others had only come later. And their method was to point out Paul's weaknesses. Chapter 10, verse 10. For some say Paul's letters are demanding and forceful, yet in person he is weak, he is speechless. His problem was that he didn't fit the stereotype of the heroic Greek leader. And remember, the Corinthians were Greeks. In fact, he seemed just the opposite. He was weak. He suffered from physical ailments of some sort. And he couldn't argue himself out of a paper bag. Or at least that's what his opponents were saying. But he had something to say to them. He says, okay, if you insist on this sort of foolishness, then let me humor you. If you want me to act as a fool, then that's what I'll do. Please don't take me too seriously. If I'm to be a fool, receive me as one. Here again, we see the similarity between their world and ours. Have you ever noticed the way our culture seems to love to brag about themselves? We don't call it bragging. We call it assertiveness. We call it presenting our credentials. We call it posting on Facebook. Letting others knowing what our potential is. Putting ourselves in the best light. But in the end, it's mostly just bragging. And that's just foolishness. Still, he says, let me indulge your foolishness. Not that this is anything that comes from the Lord, though. It's just foolishness. But then, they're obviously used to putting up with fools, since these opponents of Paul are so popular. In fact, Paul says, you don't just put up with these fools. You even let them enslave you, prey upon you, or take advantage of you. Talk about wise. At this point, his irony, his sarcasm has reached a crescendo. He says, to my shame, I must say, we are too weak for that. He seems to be saying, listen to yourselves. What are you saying? Was I too weak because I didn't take advantage of you? There's a worldly view of leadership that too easily creeps even into the church. It's the view that says leadership needs to be authoritarian, that it should push people around, and it mustn't show any signs of weakness, or it's not true leadership. It's interesting how this kind of foolishness is fed by the audience. You can't blame people for showing off when we, the onlookers, cheer when they do it. But how does that sort of leadership reflect on the nature of Christ? Well, it doesn't at all. But still, Paul hasn't finished. If they want credentials, he has them in spades. His opponents are obviously Jews. Perhaps they're the same group that seemingly seemed to follow him around, causing trouble in the early years of his ministry. They were Jewish Christians who wanted to emphasize the Jewish origins of Christianity, with a particular focus on ritual and law. A Jewish pedigree might have carried some weight in this outpost of the empire. Well, Paul could outscore them wherever they tried to outshine him. He was everything they claimed to be and more. A Hebrew? You betcha. An Israelite? Yes. A descendant of Abraham? Yes. Paul doesn't say it here, but no doubt they knew that he was a student of the teacher Gamaliel. So his understanding of the Jewish religion was without peer. And on top of that, Paul's a minister of Christ. In fact, a better one than those others. But wait, there's more. Not only is he the equal of anyone claiming Jewish heritage, he matches those who want to use the standard the Greeks to judge him. Paul writes in verse 23, I have worked harder, been put in prison more often, been whipped times without number, and faced death again and again. 5 different times the Jewish leaders gave me 39 lashes. 3 times I was beaten with rods. 1 I was stoned. 3 times I was shipwrecked. 1 I spent a whole night and a day adrift at sea. I've traveled on many long journeys. I faced danger from rivers and from robbers. I have faced danger from my own people, the Jews, as well as from the Gentiles. I have faced danger in the cities, in the deserts, and on the seas. And I have faced danger from men who claim to be believers, but are not. I have worked hard and long, enduring many sleepless nights. I have been hungry and thirsty and have often gone without food. I have shivered in the cold without enough clothing to keep me warm. Those are like the sagas of the heroes in the Greek mythology. Think of Perseus. But notice what he's done. In all this list of his exploits, there's not one success story. We all know the hero has to undergo these sorts of trials before winning, before overcoming the enemy. Hollywood movies are just the same. Every thriller or action movie Same plot. The hero fights insurmountable odds, but in the end, the heroine is rescued, the villain is caught, or better yet, annihilated. But what's the result of Paul's efforts? Verse 28. Then, besides all of this, I have the daily burden of my concerns for all the churches. Who is weak without my feeling that weakness? Who is led astray, and I do not burn with anger? No, Paul doesn't wind up the hero. He ends up exhausted and weighed down by worry. There's no mention of the converts, or the many letters he wrote, or the churches he set up and continued to encourage and build up. That wasn't the point of this exercise. He wants to show them that successful Christian ministry isn't a matter of how heroically you performed. So he goes on to show them just how unheroic he is. He tells them about the time, just after he became a Christian, when he was lowered in a basket in a very unflattering escape from Damascus, rather than risk his life at the hands of the Jews. He's no hero. He's just like what any one of us would do. When the going got tough, he ran away. Mind you, he does have his fair share of spiritual, supernatural experiences. One particular event stands out. It was a rare event, apparently. It happened once, 14 years before, but nevertheless, it was a startling one. This could be a description of his experience on the Damascus Road. Or it could be something that happened in Arabia when he was searching the scriptures to understand what he had experienced. But whatever it was, it involved an intense experience of God's presence that took him outside himself in some way to experience things that are indescribable. But even then, he's not going to boast about such an experience, because to do so would make him a real fool. This is a warning to us. It's very easy when we have some extreme spiritual experience to want to tell people about it. But if we do, we need to be careful that we're not just telling them to make ourselves look more spiritual. Do you remember what Jesus said in Matthew 6, 3 and 4 about doing good deeds? Jesus said, "But when you give to someone in need, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. Give your gifts in private, and your Father, who sees everything, will reward you." Well, if we're to keep secret what we're doing when we give an offering, how much more when we have a spiritual experience? Why doesn't he want to use this experience to convince the Corinthians? Well, probably because these sorts of experiences can so easily be counterfeited. The church has always been the target of people wanting to make themselves out to be super spiritual because of the things they say they experienced. I've seen it in a number of places. People who have a word from God, a prophecy, a word of knowledge, they don't go to the elders or the leaders of the congregation to check it out. They don't follow Paul's injunction that the spirits of prophets are subject to the prophets. They just stand up and tell the church what God's willing. They just stand up and tell the church what God's telling you to do. Well, Paul doesn't want to encourage that sort of thing, and he certainly doesn't want to base his reputation on something that can't be corroborated. No, he only wants them to go on to the things he does and says. In fact, he wants them to see that the only real grounds for boasting as a Christian aren't our exploits, but the power of God working through us. He reminds them of the ailment he suffered from, this thorn in the flesh. Now, since Paul wrote that down, people without firsthand knowledge of Paul have been debating what that thorn of the flesh was and is. But it doesn't really matter. What matters is the effect it had on Paul and the reason it was given to him. Verse 7, chapter 12, verse 7. even though I have received such wonderful revelations from God, so to keep me from becoming proud, I was given a thorn in my flesh, a messenger from Satan to torment me and keep me from becoming proud. Why was it given to him? To keep him from becoming proud. Now, if you think about it, Paul had more reason than most to be conceited, to be proud. He had more converts than almost anyone. He had certainly started more churches. He was a great teacher and evangelist, and despite what his opponents in Corinth said. But the thing is, conceit or pride and Christian ministry just don't go together. Our model is Jesus Christ, who humbled himself and became a servant. The word commonly used for Christian ministry means service. That is what a servant or a slave does. That's why I worry when I hear people saying they want increased authority in the church. The authority of a servant is all they should be after. God sent Paul this thorn to keep him humble. But notice at the same time that he describes it as a messenger of Satan. He obviously saw this thorn as something that was stopping him from doing all he could in the spread of the gospel. This was Satan doing what he could to hold Paul back. So he must have been doubly confused when God didn't remove it. You may have experienced something like this. Something happens that Satan obviously has a hand in. Something that's damaging to the kingdom or to the work of the gospel. Yet God seems to let it continue, even when you pray about it. Well, maybe something is happening to us in that situation, like what happened to Paul here. Even when he prayed that God would take it away, God said no. Whatever it was, it must have been bad, because he says he pleaded with God to have it removed. But look at what God's answer was. My grace is all you need. My power works best in weakness. Paul may not have wanted to hear that answer. None of us want to hear that we'll have to persevere in the face of suffering. But he needed to hear it. And so do we. Particularly, we Protestant evangelicals. We need to hear that the Protestant work ethic isn't an ethic of salvation, nor is it an ethic of success in ministry. But that's how we think, though, isn't it? I've got to work harder so I see fruit. We're no different from our sect in that respect, are we? We think that the harder we work, the more results will come. And that the smarter we are, the better results we'll get. Or the more spiritual we are, or the more disciplined we are, or the more we put in that plate. Now, all of those things are good. And they're good character traits to cultivate. But they don't determine the success of our ministries. How will your ministry grow? How will my ministry grow? By God's grace. God's power, in fact, will be shown to be perfect in our weaknesses. By the way, notice that God's grace is shown in our weakness. It isn't that one follows the other. You occasionally hear people talk about the need to go through a wilderness experience before you can experience the heights of God's power at work in you. It's as if they're reading Paul's story about the thorn, saying that first Paul experienced his thorn in the flesh, and then when he called upon God, he began to experience God's power again. But that's not what Paul said, was it? He continued to experience the weakness of his ailment. But his weakness only served to show how great the power of God is. And how is that power shown? Through people being converted. It wasn't that Paul was a great evangelist, so much as that when he shared the gospel, God was at work exercising his power through Paul's weak words. Here's what makes the claims of Paul's opponents so stupid. They thought he was a poor speaker, but they failed to realize that it doesn't matter. God was at work in Paul, showing his greatness by using those weak words to bring people to faith. Instead, they would have done better to join Paul in rejoicing at his weakness, rejoicing that the God we worship is powerful to save, powerful to take our weak efforts and do miracles through us. In fact, if you turn back to chapter 3, verses 1 to 3, you'll see how Paul knew that his weakness wasn't a hindrance to the gospel. Are we beginning to praise ourselves again, Paul writes? Are we like others who need to bring you letters of recommendation or who ask you to write such letters on their behalf? Surely not. The only letter of recommendation we need is you yourselves. Your lives are a letter written in our hearts. Everyone can read it and recognize our good work among you. Clearly, you are a letter from Christ showing the result of our ministry among you. This letter is not written with pen and ink, but with the Spirit of the living God. It is carved not on tablets of stone, but on human hearts. So here's the point of all of this. When you think about your ability to serve God, when you think about how useful you might be to the cause of the gospel, how successful you think you might be in sharing the gospel with someone, stop and first think about how powerful God is. Think how God, in His grace, can use your puny efforts if you let Him. On the other side of that equation, if you're someone who tends to judge the performance of others, stop and think about who it is who's at work in those people. Ask yourself whether the problem is that they're weak, or could it be that you're just unable to see the powerful God who might be working through them? As I close, may this always be a motto in our Christian service. Whenever I am weak, then I am strong.